Encounter in the Pleiades. From Preston B. Nichols' book, Encounter in the Pleiades. An Inside Look at UFOs. Introduction comment. It seems to me, having studied many contacts to Pleiadian ET, that those described here must be from a different group and confederation than the Era Pleiadians and Sempjays. From Chapter 3 Aboard a UFO. During most of the 1970s, I was working for a major defense contractor on Long Island. It was in 1974 or 75 when my boss told me that I was selected to be part of a special crew that would be examining some foreign technology located at an unspecified U.S. Air Force base. I figured we were going to look at either Russian or Chinese technology and mentioned that I would be happy to go along. I was then soberly informed that the assignment was not voluntary. I had to go. There were six of us who boarded an airplane, which flew out of Republic Field on Long Island. We flew for a while and then landed. Looking from the air, I figured that we were going to Ohio. As soon as we hit ground and before we could possibly disembark, the pilot taxied along the runway and immediately went into a hangar. We were then shuttled from the plane into the back of a van with no windows. After being driven around for 2 or 3 hours, we had no idea where we could possibly be. Eventually, the van stopped and the back doors were opened. We emerged into some sort of underground hangar that was entirely empty. There was no wind or any other descriptive features to this facility, only doors that opened and closed. From one opening, you could see a corridor. We were taken down this corridor and sent to security, where we were given a security briefing. I have said that there were six of us in total. One was my boss, but neither he nor the others remember too much of what went on. The briefing was done by Air Force personnel who were easily distinguished by their uniforms. My boss engaged in some rather lengthy dialogues with them. Finally, after being briefed on various security factors, we were taken into another hangar where we saw a disc-shaped UFO. I looked at one of the Air Force personnel and said, "Hey, that's a UFO." The airman said, "SHHH, we're not supposed to say things like that. It's a foreign aircraft." He then told us that we were visiting the Foreign Aircraft Technology Group. It was obviously a very clever use of language. The Air Force personnel representing the Foreign Aircraft Technology Group then proceeded to give us a grand tour of the UFO. From the outside, the craft was silver and looked just like a typical disc-shaped flying saucer. It appeared to be about 50 feet in diameter and 20 feet in height. There was also a dome on top that was maybe 15 feet wide. The entire craft stood on three legs that came out from the bottom. A ramp went up from the ground to a doorway on the edge of the craft. The most startling aspect of this flying saucer was apparent when I first went aboard. It was absolutely huge inside. The vessel was only 50 feet in diameter, yet we walked in one direction for what seemed to be 10 minutes. There was literally hundreds or thousands of feet of space. I couldn't explain it at the time. By today's knowledge, it is apparent that we had entered an artificial reality when boarding the ship. This aspect of the UFO is key to its construction and ability to travel from one location to another. It will be elaborated on later. Although I have said we were walking through an artificial reality, it was just as real as the environment or room you are sitting in now. The next point of interest I observed was that there were no controls anywhere to be seen. No buttons, levers or knobs. As we walked down the corridor from compartment to compartment, the lights would come on just before we arrived. I looked behind our path and noticed that the lights went off as we left an area. The lighting was very tightly controlled. As we continued to inspect the craft, one of the Air Force crew informed us that the saucer originally contained an odd atmosphere, but that it had been retrofitted so that the atmosphere was compatible with human beings. We eventually came to a compartment that was identified as the control room. The most prominent part of this area were three lounge chairs placed in the front. By lounge chairs, I mean exactly that. They were designed for reclining comfort. A group of smaller chairs were in the back. Our group was then informed that the lounge chairs contained all sorts of coils, wires and other items. It was quite apparent that when a person or creature was reclined in the lounge chair, it was designed to pick the thoughts right out of their head. Readers of the Montauk Project, Experiments in Time will note that this technology is hauntingly familiar to that of the Montauk chair. On the walls, in front of the lounge chairs, were four view screens. These were also connected to the operator's thought processes. Sitting in the chair, one could call up different maps, star charts, or photographs from outside the craft. Just by thinking the thought, one could view what was outside the craft in any direction. Behind the view screens there was another small room that had a huge cluster of rock crystals. Coils spiraled around the crystals, which were connected at various points by wiring. The walls in this room were nothing but view screens. There were no windows here or in any other portion of the craft. We were then taken one level above the control area. This was the crew's living quarters. In addition to normal creature comforts, this level contained laboratories and a big medical facility. The laboratories contained large tables possibly used for experimentation upon humans. Down below the control room, at the very bottom of the saucer, there was one huge room filled with different rock clusters which were all interconnected with wires. Neither myself nor my co-workers recognized anything in the room except for the wiring, which was very neat. It appeared to be mostly gold, silver and platinum. We were told that it did not have much copper in it. Off this bigger rock room were four smaller rooms which connected to four hemispherical pods that sat below the center of the ship. Those pods each contained an assortment of what appeared to be antennas. The bottom section of the saucer was insulated from the rest of the craft and was surrounded by a huge coil. This coil was really just a lot of turns of heavy wire and was similar to a degaussing coil used for television sets. The huge coil was connected to the large group of crystals in the central room, which appeared to be the central core of energy. This is essentially how the ship was constructed. From the technology I observed, it was apparent that this craft's drive derived from electromagnetic principles. The four pods contained antennas, which generated an electric field. The magnetic field was supplied by the electric coil mentioned above. I will give more detailed description later on. As part of our research, the coils on the saucer were activated and we put voltmeters on the wires so that we could measure the different voltages. We also observed alternating currents, various waveforms and different frequencies. The craft was levitated about 10 to 20 feet off of the hangar floor so that we could do further experimentation and tests. All sorts of antennas and very sophisticated electronic equipment had been set up, and some of it was quite unique. I had never seen it before and still haven't to this day save for this particular instance. There were signature analyzers, spectrum analyzers, and very advanced computers. Based upon my first-hand observations and the theories generated by our group, there had to be some sort of technical reality engineering system in it. What do I mean by reality engineering? Exactly that. I'm referring to the concept of building or creating a reality. If reality is defined as an agreed-upon system of perception and interaction that conforms to certain rules, reality engineering refers to changing that system. Or, more importantly, it refers to creating a different system that can interface with the original system or reality. I know that if I were building a spacecraft, I wouldn't want to rely on a ship that artificially, by machine, maintains a huge space inside of a small ship. If the machines were to fail, everything could crunch together and perhaps disappear. It could be a nightmare. If I were to do it, I would want a passive system. There would be no electricity and no power. By virtue of the physical shaped structure of the craft I had seen, an alternate reality would have to have been created on the inside. How to accomplish such a feat is another matter entirely, and that aspect will be discussed later on. After working with my engineering team, I concluded there was a single system behind the controls that used the three chairs to pick up commands from the beings in the chairs. The cluster of crystals behind the control room was a computer. The larger cluster of crystals on the lower deck, along with the antenna arrays, all within a coil around the base, I identified as a space-time reality generator. It was a self-contained system and appears to be a simple setup. After returning to my job on Long Island, there was no mention of the flying saucer field trip by any of my co-workers. It was a confidential matter and was not to be talked about. When I finally did ask my colleagues, they had no recollection. At the same time, I was having memory problems of my own. I was living a buried life that I didn't have full recognition of until years later. It was in this other life that I was able to witness another UFO. This one happened to be in the underground facility at Montauk. In my buried life, I was working at both Brookhaven Labs and on the Montauk project and saw this craft during a work assignment. This saucer was more oval-shaped than the one from Wright-Patterson that I have already described. It had the same screens and chairs, but there were also knobs and buttons in addition to a different number of operating systems. I wasn't involved in reverse engineering this craft but was assigned only to help disassemble the different systems as well as the ship itself. The craft came apart in sections, which is similar to reports that have circulated about the ships of the Grey Aliens. In both of these saucers that I witnessed up close, the hull appeared to be an entire unit in itself. As we disassembled the craft at Montauk, I thought I saw a control system, a computer system and some sort of drive, but I was never able to figure out exactly what they were. There was also a radio room of some sort. It is obvious that this vehicle was not being operated under one cohesive engineering system like the one discussed previously. This saucer was never fired up, but I am not sure why. Perhaps they couldn't operate it or didn't know how. It is obvious to me from what I have personally experienced that the UFO at Wright-Patterson was the most advanced form available and could be considered the Cadillac of flying saucers. The only thing more advanced would be a purely spiritual vehicle. I will go deeper into the technical aspects of this state-of-the-art flying saucer, but first we will examine my next personal encounter with the UFO. Next part, fellows.